It's time for another In Deep. I'm Angie Cuero. Tax day is upon us in the city of New York. A coalition of 99%ers will hit the street and the 1% with a little protest, a little theater, and a big message. The real benefits of environmentally sound cattle raising. And the state of California reconsiders solitary confinement of the youngest offenders. All of that this hour on In Deep. This is In Deep. I'm Angie Cuero. We're taking this segment of the show to talk to Congressman Ted Deutch, who has joined forces with Senator Bernie Sanders, and they are taking a bite out of Citizens United, or so they're trying to. As most of our listeners probably know, Citizens United, the judgment that really turned the political world upside down, has let an unprecedented amount of private and corporate money into the voting system. Congressman Deutch and Senator Sanders and a number of others today held a conference and a summit to talk about how this might be tackled. Congressman Deutch, thank you for making time for us.
My pleasure. Good to be with you.
From what angle can Citizens United be attacked?
Well, it can be attacked in and must be attacked in a lot of different ways. We need to amend the Constitution to overturn it. That's the most important thing we can do. Senator Sanders and I, along with a number of my other colleagues in the House, and Senator Udall in the Senate, all have various versions of constitutional amendment. But we've all come together behind Resolutions Week and the idea that local governments, state governments all over America ought to pass resolutions calling for the overturning of Citizens United via constitutional amendment, whatever form that constitutional amendment takes. We want to make sure that every corner of the country chimes in and makes clear to the people in Washington how important it is to get the corporate money out of politics and return democracy to our people.
You know, I've been paying attention to the political scene for about a quarter of a century now, and in a peculiar way, it strikes me that Citizens United almost has a silver lining because it seems to have accelerated the pace at which people are realizing that money has undue influence on politics and who holds power in the U.S.
Yeah, I think that's right. And listen, I thought it was a horrible decision, and I'm sorry that the court ruled the way they did, but it really has, I think, galvanized real support for changing the system. And it's really shed a spotlight on the fact that the agenda in Washington is in so many ways driven by these special interests that that really have occupied the halls of power for too long. There is such strong support now in every segment of the community in all parts of the country to do something about it and to do it now.
Is there anything, now I understand that you're working on this on a much higher level than the average citizen could, and I'm really glad you've done it, but while you gather together your possibilities and the potential ways to act on Citizens United, what can the average citizen be doing between now and the time that this, you know, we have an election coming up? Is there anything within the power of the individual citizen to be doing?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first of all, I encourage people to check out the website for our amendment, theoccupiedamendment.org. I learned some more about what Senator Sanders and I are trying to do. But there's also another, and sign our petition too, which is important. The other thing people can do is they can go to resolutionsweek.org and they can learn about what they can do in their own community to go out and work with the city council, work with the county commission, work with the state government to pass a resolution. And this is something that people all around the country can do. It's grassroots, and it's really vitally important, this cause.
Let's talk a little bit. And by the way, all of those web addresses are going to be on our site, indeepradio.com. So for any listeners for whom that went by too fast or you're driving, you can pick it up there at our website. We'll link to it. Of course, one of the biggest issues facing us in politics right now is this massive divide, this massive Republican, Democratic, conservative, liberal divide. Is there some unified vision, do you think, that can help us crush that divide or reach across that divide? Is there enough shared concern here that Citizens United might be tackled by everyone?
Well, at this point, I think there may be one Republican in the House who's involved in one of the constitutional amendments. But out in the real world, outside of Washington, it's pretty clear that this is not a partisan issue. And Republicans, Democrats, everyone is disgusted by the way that corporate money is really being used to influence the outcome of elections. We've seen it all throughout the presidential primaries, and it's only going to get worse as we head to Election Day. So I think this is really a bottom-up approach, and it's from the grassroots that we're going to really be able to succeed.
In fact, I actually have heard conjecture from a number of parties that you wouldn't think that the far left could unify with the Tea Party on anything. But in fact, the Tea Party is on record as really opposing the role of money in politics, as really wanting to get true representatives of the people in Congress. And that's what this would be about. So maybe we can unify over that.
I certainly hope so. It's what we need to do, and we need to do it now.
So this summit is going to be held on April 18th, and there are invitations open to that, and we're going to put the invitations and the links all on our website. Anything else our listeners need to know before we let you go?
No, but I would encourage people to take a look at the summit. Is going to be great. There are more than a dozen groups involved, all sorts of good government groups, public interest groups, people who understand how important it is to restore democracy and get the corporate money out of politics. And then all of my colleagues who have been so involved in preparing constitutional amendments, we all have different thoughts on exactly how they ought to be written and what we ought to do, but we're all coming together to work hard to give people all around the country the opportunity to get out, to work with their local governments, and to go out to all their candidates and ask them to sign a declaration for democracy, committing, in whatever form, committing to overturn Citizens United and amend the Constitution.
Congressman Deutsch, I'm so grateful for your time. Thank you.
It's my pleasure. Thanks so much. I'll talk to you soon.
All right. And it's Congressman Ted Deutsch. We'll put a link to his website up on ours as well at indeepradio.com. This is In Deep. I'm Angie Coiro. Well, tax day is just about upon us. And boy, taxes have a lot of implications nowadays, don't they? Now that you know that you're probably paying more than your fair share, and there are an awful lot of people, 1%, who aren't. So fortunately, we're not alone in fighting this discrepancy. First of all, the Buffett rule is out there with President Obama behind it and a lot of other people trying to charge millionaires their fair share. And there are foot soldiers out there on the street making the point known, getting the word out, and we're going to talk to one of them right now. Camille Rivera is Executive Director of United New York. And Camille, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
I'm glad to learn of United New York. I hadn't been familiar, and you guys do some great theater. Your motto is fighting for a city that works for all. I want to share with our listeners when Mitt Romney showed up. This is reading from your blog. Mr. 1% himself was in town. We made sure to give him a 99% welcome. While the 1% dined inside, we were outside holding the ashes of the jobs he destroyed with Bain Capital. And you had a big urn that said cremator, and it had Grim Reapers carrying it around. And I think this kind of, it makes the point, but it makes it with humor. And people can glom onto that and relate to that, in some cases more than they can with anger.
Yeah, no, it really was. I mean, we don't want to be too kind of toyish around the actions that we take, but we do want to send a strong message. And we have found that visually, it makes a lot of sense to do this type of stuff because people actually do take this stuff seriously. And so for the Romney action, we really wanted to make a statement that Mitt was a job cutter, and that he had proven examples of being a job cutter by being, you know, with Bain Capital, by the policies that he's supporting and is supporting. And so it really kind of resonated with people, and we had this big urn, and people were just kind of saying, this is the job that you're killed, nursing jobs, you know, building trade jobs, you know, janitors, you know, security officers, you know, so teachers. And so it really kind of resonated with the news. And we try to be very kind of serious, but also get a little bit of poke, a little bit of fun, but at the same time, really create a message that people could really understand very clearly.
Well, in fact, you're getting out there to get that message out on tax day. And tax day this year is put off 48 hours because the 15th falls on a weekend. So April 17th, the 99% and the many groups that you're working with are going to be getting the word out there to people as they're paying their taxes. So what do you have in mind for them?
You know, we're going to take tax day back to the 99% this year. Last year and the year before, the Tea Party really kind of took hold of the message. We have a lot of stuff in store. We really want to have working people be the ones to really send the message that we're tired of big banks and corporations not paying their fair share. And so we're going to start very early in the morning at 8 a.m. where people can adopt their post office and do soapboxes for people as they're coming in to pay their taxes and file. And we're going to have working people talk about the big corporations and banks that that have attributed to job loss, to cuts in services, to to not allowing our economic stability in this country. And we're going to have working people tell their stories. At 11 o'clock, we're going to the post office, and we're going to have, you know, a number of different people, working New Yorkers, unemployed people, retirees, students, basically come out and basically bring their tax bills and basically say, hey, I just paid my taxes, GE, Bank of America, J.P. Morgan, Morgan Stanley, why haven't you paid yours? And we're going to tell a whole bunch of different stories about people who have had real, you know, real problems, and have worked really hard, and at the same time are struggling while the 1% doesn't pay their fair share. And then we're going to have our tax dodgers. If you've seen our website, we have tax dodgers who dress up in baseball outfits and represent the 1%. It's actually pretty fun. And we do a whole skit, and working people actually participate. Regular people actually participate in the tax dodgers event. And they're going to be going to GE, Bain Capital. They're going to be going to Henry Paulson Group. They might stop by the Mitt Romney fundraiser, the Ann Romney Fund birthday fundraiser, and they're just going to be basically sending, giving out stickers and basically sending this real important message: hey, the big corporations are giving away free money, are getting away with getting free money, and this is your share. And so we're planning on putting like little envelopes that basically say free money on it, and a little card with a penny in it. And so this is your free money, because this is what you get in pennies. This is what the corporations get. And I think it's the way to kind of engage working people who don't have time to participate in rallies and protests, but really get angry about what's happening in our country. So we're going to do that, and we're going to culminate at 4:30 in front of two sites, Bank of America, 42nd and 6th, and then Henry Paulson on 50th and 6th, which is the one of the major hedge funds in the city. And we're going to march on all the tax dodges. We're planning on stopping by Chase, where students are going to do an action around the amount of debt. Chase has many of its students and graduates, the people who are graduating this year, mm-hmm. And do some type of visual around that. We're going to stop at Wells Fargo, and then we're going to culminate at the post office, where we'll probably do some speak-outs and talk a little bit about what big corporations have been doing to this country. And then, you know, maybe there'll be some actions in the evening. Who knows? So we're trying to figure out the theater style actions in the evening.
One of the things I'm going to be curious to see, Camille, when all is said and done, one of the things that stood out for those of us who hit the streets and made our point to protest the war in Iraq and the war in Afghanistan and what was happening under George Bush, and we could not get the press to cover us. We had tens of thousands of people in major cities, some in many cases international, and we couldn't get the press to cover it. And then the Tea Party came along. And it seemed like if you get 12 Tea Party members with some catchy signs out there, they showed up on every network in the country. And there was a lot of discussion about why it was difficult to get them to cover what was essentially a progressive movement. So let me just ask, do you anticipate, with all of this advanced planning and you're doing some heavy-duty outreach, is there anything you have in mind to make the media pay attention to carrying the message beyond just the people who might see you on that given day?
Well, we're doing, I mean, I think the way is to really tell the real story. Right? I feel like the press really resonates around the person who's really affected. So the person who is being foreclosed upon by Bank of America, who hasn't paid a dime in taxes in over 3 years, but also continues to foreclose on homes, right? And tell that story actually resonates with people. And if you think about the Iraq war and Afghanistan war, people were actually caring about the soldiers who were coming home, right? What was happening to them? And that was what really resonated for people. And of course, I mean, of course the protests really resonated, but I think that the personal story that was connected to that mm-hmm. actually basically sent the message, well, we actually have to stop and we have to end this war because our soldiers are suffering, our families are suffering, and that's why we have to end it. Obviously, there's a whole bunch of reasons why we have to end it, but I think with big banks and corporations, the only way to really send a message is to really personalize it. So you have Occupy the Boardroom, and I don't know if you've ever been there, but if you go to www.occupytheboardroom, there are thousands of letters and emails that people have sent to big corporations that tell real stories about how they're really being affected by the irresponsibility of big banks and corporations getting away with not paying their fair share, not being accountable, continuing to make money off the backs of workers, and then asking workers to give back, right? Pushing their legislation and pushing governments to actually crank down on and be, you know, be and have a form of austerity that we can't possibly afford. And so I really do think, you know, that that's actually one of the things that helps bring it to the mainstream. I also think, look, I mean, the Occupy movement has done, you know, has done an amazing job in really grasping a message of the 1% versus the 99%, and has put it out so simply that people actually really want to make, really want to own that as well. It's a message that people can own, right? Like, my mother is a state worker, right, retired, and she says, well, I'm the 99%. I mean, my mother's, she's never been to Zuccotti Park. She's never, you know, been to a protest, but it resonates through the media that she is somebody that represents everyday working people.
Go mom. Good. I'm glad she's getting, and you know, cool. And this is what we hear. We do hear people who they don't really grasp, or they don't care about whether they're progressive or liberal or conservative. They may not even relate to politics, but they can relate to what's happening to their own paychecks and their own neighbors and their unemployed cousin. And this is what I think brings the 99% together. When you're planning your actions for the April 17th, and I should note, you've got a whole passel of groups working with you. You're with United New York. I'm talking to Camille Rivera, who's executive director of United New York. Working Families Party is working on this. The CWA, War Resisters League, the TWU, the Central Labor Council. I mean, we've got almost a dozen groups here working together on this. Do you anticipate getting any pushback from people who consider this a bunch of libs? And how are you ready to communicate with those people? How are you ready to let them know that this is about them too?
I mean, I think, like, everyday labor organizations, like 32BJ, CRU, Communications Workers of America, those are like the real people of New York City and the country, right? Those are regular people. These are people that are supporting this because it's not left wing stuff to ask people to pay their fair share in taxes. It's actually not like a radical thing for people to pay their fair share. Everybody feels like they're being taxed too much, or they're not being taxed fairly. So everybody really believes that this is the right thing to do. And I think that the diversity of people that you will see on the 17th will be an example that this is not just just kind of a left-wing, radical, progressive idea. That we're not just having 10 signs in front of the post office and saying, hey, big corporations are not paying their fair share, but a diverse group of people who are really doing something big here, who are part of a movement. I mean, Occupy has opened up a lot of doors for people to actually say, hey, wait a minute, right? Like, something is actually happening here, and I'm actually a part of that. Mm-hmm. And it actually forces people to really come out and say, actually, it's not crazy to go and protest. It's actually not crazy to go and march, right, to the post office and demand that big corporations pay their fair share. It's actually something that people really want to do, right, that we actually have a right to do and should be doing because nobody's listening. So I really do think that's actually changing. In the Romney actions, we had a lot of news coverage on TV. One, because it's Romney and it's New York, but two, because working people were out there, right, really just sending a message that they're really tired of being pushed around.
I need to ask you before we let you go, for our listeners who are hearing this and won't be able to participate, is there a hashtag we can follow on Twitter to at least follow vicariously?
Yes.
What's that?
Yes. Hashtag tax day. It's tax day, one word. And hashtag fair share. And so they can follow us on Twitter. They can follow us. We're trying to see if we can live stream it. We don't know if we'll be able to, but we'll be putting up updates on our Facebook page as well as our website. We have Beyond May 12th as well. People can go to the Facebook page on Beyond May 12th, go to the events. It'll be tax day. They can go there. They can RSVP, and they can learn a whole bunch more about how they can get involved.
Camille, you rock. I wish you a great day out there, and I thank you for what you're doing.
Thank you for having me.
Camille Rivera, Executive Director of United New York. You can follow our hashtag, too. We are In Deep Radio on Twitter and In Deep with Angie Coiro on Facebook. There's more to come. I'm Angie Coiro. This is In Deep.
You're a rich girl, and you've gone too far, 'cause you know it don't matter anyway. You can rely on the old man's money. You can rely on the old man's money. It's a bitch, girl, but it's gone too far, 'cause you know it don't matter anyway. say money, money won't get you too far, get you too far. And don't you know?
This is In Deep. I'm Angie Cuero. FDA regulations on poultry feed and meat inspections, and then, of course, the ongoing story about the quote-unquote pink slime, really have a lot of people thinking about meat and meat production, how safe the food is in our food chain, whether you're getting a mouthful of antibiotics when you have a mouthful of chicken. Let's talk about the kind of world where food is produced without many of those worries, but organic meat production brings on some of its very own worries. We're talking to people who have just a barrel full of experience with that, and you'll probably recognize the last name. Bill and Nicolette Han Nyman are the originators of Nyman Ranch. Bill and Nicolette now run BN Ranch. It's a seaside ranch in Bolinas, California, and they've got grass-fed cattle out there, heritage turkeys and goats, and their name is known far and wide, and they are other avocations as well. Nicolette, for example, is an attorney and a writer, and Bill is a founder of Nyman Ranch, the aforementioned Nyman Ranch, and a member of Pew's National Commission on Industrial Farm Animal Production. I want to say thank you to both of you for joining us this afternoon.
We're happy to be here. Thank you.
Bill, I want to start with you because you started Nyman Ranch, and of course that meat is still very much out there on the market, very highly respected, and you moved to scale it back, and with Nicolette, you started up the BN Ranch. Tell me about what you wanted to do differently the second time around.
Well, we actually wanted to pioneer a new and better way of raising livestock, and that really is kind of returning to the more sensible methods of allowing animals to live on pasture and convert naturally occurring forage to wholesome, delicious food for human consumption. So our model today is really about pasture and grasses as opposed to grain and shipping and harvesting large amounts of concentrated grains to cattle or pigs or chickens and so on. So we're hoping that we can, again, pioneer this more sensible method and bring it back into vogue as it was in this country up until World War II.
Nicolette, this almost sounds like an ironic twist on what a lot of humans are trying to do now. They're trying to eat what's available within a one-mile radius. It sounds as though you're doing the same thing with the animals, is they're eating the pasture and the stuff that is naturally available where they are. Am I hearing that right?
Well, there's, you know, it would never be possible to raise all of the food that would be needed for urban areas, for example, within, you know, a couple of miles of those urban areas. So there's always going to be some shipping of food, and both Bill and I are big believers that certain geographies are best suited for certain types of agriculture. So we do support the raising of food and shipping at a certain amount of, you know, distance when necessary. But it makes a lot of sense for all of food production to move towards a more regionalized system, because there is a lot of expenditure of energy and there are environmental consequences for shipping food and for shipping feed long distances. And so just trying to have food more, we wouldn't really call it local food, but we think of it more as regional food systems is what we're really big believers in.
You know, one of the things, and I want to draw our listeners' attention to something we have on our website. We often record extra bits of the show that don't air, and we have what we call a web extra with someone from the Natural Resources Defense Council, and he's talking about the FDA regulation of antibiotics in poultry. Now, once they've listened to that, and then they hear our interview, I would think one of their first question is, well, if you're not going to use antibiotics, if you're not going to force those into the chickens or, you know, the roosters or the turkey system, how are you going to protect against disease that can then be passed on to the consumer? Bill, do you want to field that one?
Sure. Well, one of the things that we've advocated for is not to use antibiotics to replace good animal husbandry. So if you're going to create an environment that's going to stress animals and they're going to be concentrated in small areas and overcrowded, not only is that going to encourage diseases, but it's going to guarantee that if there is illness in your flock or herd, it's going to spread rampantly to the others. So we are supportive of treating animals that are ill, but we're much more supportive of creating an environment where animals can thrive and be healthy.
And actually, I think if I could add something to this, it's important to note that there were very few antibiotics weren't even developed until the middle of the 20th century, and they were not used in animal agriculture really at all until about 1950. And then they began, in fact, they began in poultry production when animals began to be held in more crowded conditions, because there was so much more death and disease when you had animals confined indoors continually and you had them crowded, and that's what necessitated adding the antibiotics to the feed. So we're not, as Bill mentioned, we don't believe that there's no place for modern medicine and modern technology in animal production and in farming. We think it's a really important part of it. But what we're against is overusing antibiotics and using it instead of appropriate living conditions for animals. That's what's being done today, and that's what we're opposed to and what we don't do.
Yeah. Angie, I think the European model, they've outlawed the use of antibiotics many years ago as subtherapeutic antibiotics that promote growth. And, you know, initially when the ban was implemented, there were some therapeutic problems and outbreaks of disease more than prior to the ban. But as soon as the farmers, the animal food production people there, adjusted their husbandry to coincide with the lack of use of antibiotics prophylactically or in the ration, the things got into balance again. So it really was about creating a husbandry method that allowed the animals to thrive as opposed to stressing them. And the European model is an excellent example of that, and the successes they've had there point the way for us.
You know, I'd like the two of you, if you could, for me to contrast the life of a heritage turkey on BN Ranch. And Nicolette, as you described, you know, the crowded industrial conditions that still prevail for a lot of poultry in industrial farming. So what's the life of a heritage turkey at your place versus a turkey raised for mass production in a standard industrialized ranch?
Well, probably the biggest difference is how crowded they are. So we have, first of all of our turkeys are outside every day. They have access to the outdoors, and they have a lot of room when they do come in at night, and they're in barns at night, but they're never in really crowded conditions. Even when they're inside, they have quite a bit of space. So that just makes a big difference. If you think of, a really crowded subway station, you know, where people are sneezing, you kind of know right away that you might catch that cold. It's the same thing with any time you have animals and you have them really tightly packed together. There's just much more probability of disease transmission. And actually, there's really good research done at Johns Hopkins University showing that there's a lot more mutation of diseases to make really resistant strains. So our animals are never really crowded. They have a lot of opportunity to get exercise, to breathe fresh air, and their feed is also a natural feed that doesn't contain, you know, obviously the drugs we're talking about, but also other additive, chemical additives or drug additives. So they're eating, they're just living a healthy life as the same way, you know, a human trying to be healthy would do in terms of exercising, eating right, breathing fresh air. All those things keep animals healthy as well.
You know, Angie, 99% of the turkeys being raised today never breathe outside or fresh air, never see the sun. You know, they're raised in completely closed buildings. And this is true, in fact, of natural or antibiotic-free turkeys as well. So it doesn't sound so extraordinary that they have some room to move around and they can be outside day or night, unfettered access to the outdoors. But it is really, that's the 1%, the other 1%, if you will.
Oh. We're talking with Bill Nyman and Nicolette Han Nyman. They're the owners and operators of BN Ranch. And we're talking about the life of organic poultry and goats and grass-fed cattle as opposed to the industrial system. We're going to come back for another segment with them. I'm Angie Coro. This is In Deep. Welcome back to In Deep. I'm Angie Coro. I'm talking to Bill Nyman and Nicolette Han Nyman. They are the owners and operators of BN Ranch. They have their son Miles being raised there alongside cattle, heritage turkeys, and goats. And we're talking about the comparisons between industrialized raising of cattle and poultry versus what they're doing out there, which is raising them in a much more natural situation. And we were comparing those two when we took our break here, Bill. Can you talk about another aspect of this? And that is, I can hear the compassion that you have for the animals with what you said right before the break about how so many poultry never even see sunlight. They're indoors their entire life. And I wonder about having that level of compassion even as you're raising animals for food. Can you tell me about how that works in your mind, that what impressions that leaves with you?
I actually find it hard to believe that farmers can create environments like that and think it's okay. And what's troubling is that the next generation of farmers are growing up and thinking that this is the way it's supposed to be without having had experience of interacting or observing animals living in a more natural setting and, you know, really begin to develop an affinity for them and just to know what kind of life to provide for them so they can thrive. So I really find that troubling. And it's important, very important to us to create the best possible environment for the animals, even though we are raising them for slaughter and they are going to be processed, harvested for food. We believe that they should only have one bad day on the farm. And that's what really drives us every day to work with them and provide an environment that as much as possible mirrors what they do in nature.
I like that. Is that a phrase that the two of you use often, only have one bad day on the farm? Because I think that encapsulates it beautifully.
Well, I have to credit Paul Willis, the number one hog farmer, the number one of about 700 at Nyman Ranch Pork Company, for coming up with that phrase. So, people who raise animals for food talk about this issue a lot, and that's no one enjoys having to put them on the truck to go to slaughter, but we are really concerned about the joy of raising animals for food is feeding people. And we're really concerned about how they were raised and how wholesome the meat from those animals are. And the joy of feeding people really wholesome, healthful, and delicious food makes it all possible.
Nicolette, I want to probe into some of the other work that you've done because it's all interwoven. You were senior attorney for the environmental group Waterkeeper Alliance. And if there's one thing those of us who've studied industrial farming know, that it's dangerous for the aquifer, it's dangerous for the water tables and the water systems nearby. There's a lot of stuff that leaves industrial farm and ends up where it doesn't belong. Tell me how that compares to the situation that you've set up there on BN Ranch.
Yeah, well, these issues are all interrelated. Because historically farming, you know, it could be a factor in pollution, but in general, agriculture was not a major pollution problem in the United States for most of its history. And it became the leading cause of water pollution in the United States a little more than a decade ago, and it is still today. And the reason for that is because we have so dramatically changed our farming practices in this country over the past couple of decades. We've become extremely reliant on chemicals, and we have, you know, kind of abandoned all the sort of traditional methods for preserving soil and for preventing soil from eroding, and that nowadays that means also all the chemicals running off. And when it comes to animal agriculture,
it's all about concentration now. So you have pretty much, you know, other than a small number of dairy cattle and beef cattle, really all of the animals have sort of been brought in off of the land and put into confined buildings and in very large populations. So rather than having animals kind of dispersed around the country and kind of in small flocks and herds, now they're concentrated in these large, you know, I mean, a comparison, you know, early 20th century, a typical chicken flock would be a couple of dozen chickens, and nowadays a typical chicken house has 100,000 chickens in it.
Whoa.
So you can just imagine, you know, the difference in the quantity of manure that is produced and chicken litter, as they call it, what's coming out of the poultry house, and then also just what you have to bring into the operation is totally different. So environmentally, that has totally different consequences, and the main pollution problem from these animal operations is the water contamination, what's running down into the groundwater and running off into surface water. So the overusage of antibiotics is also linked to that, because there's been a lot of research done that shows a high that it's extremely common to find antibiotic residues as well as antibiotic resistant bacteria in the runoff from these operations. So the fact that these antibiotics are being used so much is also a pollution and a public health problem that's kind of all related.
You know, I know that you folks aren't raising chickens there per se. You're raising, and perhaps you are. Do you have chickens as well?
No, we don't right now at this time.
Okay, but I'll bet you can answer this one for me anyway, so I'm going to throw it at you, and I'll let either of you answer it. I try to be an informed consumer, and I go to the grocery store, and I stand in front of a selection of chicken eggs that are marked in so many different confusing ways, I don't know whether I'm doing the right thing or not. Some of them say they're free range. Some of them say they're cage free. Others say no antibiotics. Others say they're raised on a natural diet. And at some point I say, which is which? What am I looking for here? So some advice, please, on how to shop responsibly for chicken eggs.
Yeah, well, eggs, you know, they're all the species are a little bit different. But when you're talking about eggs, actually, the term free range hasn't actually been defined by the government, so it isn't really that meaningful. In other words, somebody could slap that label onto their package, since it hasn't really been defined, it could mean just about anything. However, I would say this. Cage-free does have a significance because most chickens, most egg-laying chickens, most hens, are still, in fact, in this country, kept in very small cages, very restrictive cages, for their entire productive lives. And if you see something that says cage-free, that means it's not being raised that way. So it's probably still in a large, confined operation, but at least it's not in these battery cages, these very tight, very cramped conditions, which are the most troubling of all aspect of the egg production side. So I would say, at the minimum, you want to search for something that says it was raised without being fed antibiotics, and you want to look for something that says it's cage-free. Now, the very best eggs you can find are those where the hens were out on grass, like we've talked about before. That's kind of the gold standard for all animals, to have them outside and especially on grass. And it makes the food not just safer, but also much tastier. So, it's something that it's worth it to pay the extra money for, we believe.
You know, there's
and
so
more nutritious as well. And I think you'll find the pasture-raised livestock and eggs and the dairy, the milk from pasture-raised dairy cattle, more nutritious.
Oh, actually, there's a lot of research on the nutritional advantages for eggs, as well as Bill said and the other species as well, but talking about eggs, whether it's the vitamin E content, which is much, much higher, or the beneficial amino acids, all those things are significantly higher when the hens have had the opportunity to graze.
I'm afraid the clock has caught us, but you guys have just been marvelous. I hope if you make your way to Berkeley, we can sit down and continue this conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Angie. Thank you for having us.
Bill Nyman and Nicolette Hahn Nyman, they are the owners and operators of BN Ranch. And this is In Deep. I'm Angie Coiro.
sometimes I want it, sometimes two. That's enough for the whole damn crew. Go ahead, look insane. Eating dicks and with our brain. Look ahead, look in the small. Sometimes nine and sometimes ten. That's enough for the real old man. Move ahead, look insane. Evening makes a way last spring. Go ahead, look insane.
Welcome back to In Deep. I'm Angie Cuero. Our last guest this hour brought something to my attention that I frankly had not thought about. It's one of the things that once you're confronted with it, of course it's an issue. In this case, youth who are, for whatever reason, in a facility for having misbehaved in some kind of youth prison and facing the specter of solitary confinement. Think about being alone in a room with little or no stimulation. We're 23 of every 24 hours. Think of a mature adult having to cope with that solitude. And now think about being 12 or 13 or 15 and having to deal with that as well. It's an issue that Leland Yee has tackled here from California. He is proposing that this sort of thing be highly regulated, if not eliminated altogether. So we turn to our friends at the Ella Baker Center here in Oakland to explain to us what the issue is and how it might be tackled. Let me welcome to our show Jennifer Kim. She's Senior Policy Analyst for Books Not Bars. That's a campaign of the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights. Jennifer, hi.
Hi, thank you for having me.
I think the first issue to understanding a problem like this is quantifying is how many people, how many children, teenagers face solitary confinement as an issue?
So we have two levels of systems in California. We have the state youth prison system where we have about 1,000 young people who are locked up, and then a county system that has, you know, tens of thousands of kids who are kind of in and out of juvenile hall and different camps, ranches. And so our campaign focuses mostly on the young people who are locked up in the state youth prisons. And basically any of them can be subjected to solitary confinement. They have separate units where, you know, kids are locked up for 22, 23, 24 hours a day. It could be, you know, 30 kids. It could be 50 kids. It really depends on each facility and their practice. The issue is that the existing regulations and laws around guiding how this practice can be used are too broad and don't provide enough guidance for facility administrators to curb the practice and to make sure that the impact on young people, you know, is minimized.
So this is a move for the state of California to regulate or to minimize the use of solitary confinement. But in your information, you let on that it's attached to such bad things, even as much as suicide. So wouldn't it be better to eliminate it altogether?
So ideally, we would ban the use of solitary confinement because it actually has no rehabilitative value. And it is proven in reports and studies that it causes irreparable trauma in both healthy adults as well as, you know, children, adults that have mental health issues. And so, you know, ideally, we would live in a world where we did not have solitary confinement. Considering that in correctional environments, solitary confinement is used to kind of address security issues that come up, we have placed limitations around exactly how often it can be used and for how long. And so we want to make sure that when they decide to implement solitary confinement, that it's used in the most restricted way possible. So let's, you know, look at all the other kind of alternatives to using solitary confinement before we even decide to put a young person in a cell for 23 hours a day. So let's look at counseling. Let's look at talking down the young person, before we resort to that.
You know, it's interesting.
I was going to say, the other issue is that a lot of people think that solitary confinement is used only for kids who start fights, and it threatens the institutional safety, and that's why we need to separate these young people. The other time that solitary confinement is also used is when we have kids that are suicidal. Kids who are suicidal are often placed in solitary confinement because, you know, these facility administrators think that it's their way of keeping them safe.
Really?
And so you have to ask yourself, you have to ask yourself, you know, if you're a parent with a kid who is suicidal, would you then separate him or her, you know, from, you know, human contact, place them in a room and expect that kid to, you know, get better by himself?
Yeah, in fact, let me take this from your fact sheet, which is really striking to me. Your fact sheet says nationally, well, this is out, you're dealing with California with this particular issue, but it's a national problem. And the fact sheet says nationally, over half the youth who committed suicide while in a correctional facility were in solitary confinement at the time, and 62% had a history of being placed in solitary confinement. You know, and we all know that coincidence doesn't mean causality, but that's pretty powerful. That's a heavy indictment.
Right. We actually have two family members that, you know, their two kids, they committed suicide back in the early 2000s, and they were both in solitary. And we have, you know, a young person right now that whose parent is kind of, you know, our spokesperson around this bill, who has, you know, once he exhibited these acts of self-harm, their immediate response is to stick him in a solitary cell. And, you know, he stopped eating, and, you know, at that point, you know, you think that a mental health person will come and ask him why he's not eating. You know, they don't ask any of that. They just kind of leave the kid in there, and hopefully, you know, things will work out.
Jennifer Kim is with the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights Books Not Bars campaign. She's senior policy analyst with the group. We're talking about legislation sponsored here in California by Senator Leland Yee. Not to eliminate, which would be the better ideal, but to at least regulate more strongly solitary confinement for young people. Jennifer, let's talk about the whole concept of prison, because I think underpinning this is that constant battle we have whether prison ought to be punitive or rehabilitative. And if you're trying to punish a kid, you take away his toys, you take away his friends, you take away his music, and you stick him in a room. And it sounds like that's the mentality that's guiding solitary confinement. It's punitive.
Right. The thing is that in California, though, legally, they're required to provide rehabilitation. So, you know, we have a separate juvenile system for a reason. It's not supposed to be like the adult system where, you know, people are just locked up and they're punished. You know, with the juvenile justice system, there's a legal mandate that requires them to provide programming, that provides counseling, education. And so when you have a practice like solitary confinement that runs contrary to that goal, it needs to be removed.
And I guess that goes to the philosophy of what is in fact rehabilitative. You mentioned earlier that some people posit this as a way to keep the child safe, which is something I still don't grasp how you could arrive at that. It almost seems as though the attitude, if not the policy, is punitive.
Right. I mean, the idea is that, you know, when, you know, parents lose custody of their children and these kids become wards of the state, you know, the most basic expectation that parents have is that their children are kept safe. And so if their child is exhibiting suicidal behavior, you want the state to do what you would do as a parent. I would take my child to a hospital. You know, if we're talking about, you know, a life or death situation. And so if their answer to that is to place a young person in a concrete cold cell with none of their belongings, at times shackled with a camera that kind of is used to monitor the child, I don't know how that helps the young person get better. I don't know how it removes that risk of suicide
No, it's it's hard to draw the line from one to the other. Right. Although you do have an interesting, when I say you, I mean the Ella Baker Center and the work that Senator Leland Yee has done. An interesting line that you do draw is that solitary confinement in other contexts has been condemned as torture.
Yes. I mean, internationally, you know, solitary confinement is defined as torture, and the UN has come out and said it should be absolutely banned when applied to young people, to juveniles. So we are out of step with international standards. There are also, you know, several states that have passed laws to prevent the use of solitary confinement for punitive reasons, for disciplinary reasons. California doesn't even have that in the books. And so we're kind of behind in a lot of ways, and we hope that SB 1363 will, you know, kind of push this conversation forward as to what kind of juvenile justice system do we want to create for our children? What is it that we want these kids to experience in what's supposed to be a rehabilitative setting that's going to help them when they come out to kind of make better decisions and to get back on track with their lives.
Which you would hope would be the whole point of them being there. Let me ask you about the profile of this problem, because, you know, as I had explained to you, I wasn't really even aware that this was a practice that was widespread, that was so poorly regulated. I consider myself politically astute and pretty well read. I'm on top of the news sites all day long. Has there been an issue for the Ella Baker Center and for other groups who care about this? Has it been an issue of trying to raise the profile of it? Are people aware this is an issue?
I think that, you know, well, last year with the hunger strike that was happening in Pelican Bay, I think people started talking about and thinking about the use of solitary confinement, at least with the adult prisoners. Oftentimes, our juvenile justice system is kind of, you know, out of sight, out of mind. People's perception of the juvenile justice system is that, you know, it's, you know, kids are getting services, they're getting the help that they need to get better. Unless there's this constant monitoring and educating ourselves about what's actually happening to our young people, then, you know, then we're not going to know. We need to hold these systems accountable. Our youth prisons right now, we're spending over $200,000 for each young person to lock them up. Over 90% of them are youth of color. And of the about 1,000 young people who are locked up, only 30 of them are young women.
Wow.
So we have a system. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I hadn't realized the disparity.
It's a huge, huge, disgusting disparity. And at the same time, the recidivism rate is 81%. It's one of the highest in the nation. And, you know, we consider at least the youth prisons, you know, kind of a pit stop to the adult prisons. They're not getting the services that they need, and if anything, the system is adding damage upon damage to our kids.
You mentioned in some of the presentation of this problem that here in California, the Division of Juvenile Justice is undergoing its own problems, and some of this responsibility is going to go from the state to the counties. Is that how I understand it?
Well, we've been pushing for the closure of the state youth prisons because we don't think that they can be reformed. So we think that services can be delivered at the local level where there can be more accountability. The kids are closer to home. Families can be play a much larger role in the rehabilitative process. And so that's what we've been pushing for. And that's part of the reason why this bill applies to both the youth prisons and the juvenile facilities at the counties, because we want to make sure that when we do eventually see one system, that these standards are going to be in place so that we don't take our kids that are the most vulnerable in terms of having the highest needs, and because we say, well, we don't know what to do with these kids, we're just going to place them in solitary. We want to kind of prevent that from happening.
Yeah, understandably. Now, of course, our show is heard across the country, and I know that one of the concerns in other states, one of the concerns in many states, is that there's a lack of money for any kind of programs for rehabilitative, for jails, for and I guess that one of the issues that comes to mind with solitary confinement is anything that doesn't work toward the goal of effective rehabilitation is ultimately going to cost the state, the county, the system more, because you do have recidivism. If you're not dealing with someone's mental health, they're going to come right back and go through the system again.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. I mean, the issue is that, you know, when our young people are locked up, they need to be in structured programming. They need to be in school. California, you're legally required to have to receive 4 hours of education every day. That's not going to happen when you're locked up in a cell. Mm-hmm. And so anytime you suspend these programs that, you know, are part of the rehabilitative goals of, you know, the system, then what you're doing is you're just growing the population of young people that are going to just remain in it.
I know there's probably not one standard from one facility to the next, but just in general, what does solitary confinement mean? Does the kid have books? Does he have a radio? Does he have light? What does he have access to?
Mm-hmm. So it varies. Some of the young people in these prisons don't have access to, you know, they don't have access to books. They don't have access to some of the regular clothing. The kids who are there for suicide watch are often just in, you know, maybe like a hospital gown or a T-shirt and boxers or something like that. They don't have access to their usual personal belongings. And I've actually visited some of these units, and they're, you know, they're just really like dirty, cold, you know, bare cells. They have a concrete slab that's supposed to serve as their bed, and they get this thin mattress that, you know, they put on top of the slab. They may have a toilet, they may not, depending on the young person's risk for suicide.
Oh, my God.
So, yeah.
What are they supposed to do if they need to use a restroom?
They, basically, the guards are supposed to check on them, and then I think they are either escorted to a bathroom or, I'm not sure.
Wow. This sounds medieval.
Yeah.
It really does.
Yeah, I mean, they did their own, the Department of Corrections did their own audit last year, and we found out that there was one kid who was let out for 1 hour over a course of 10 days. And so, you know, it's really appalling considering the amount of resources that we're putting into our state youth prison system, and seeing the practices that are resulting from that kind of taxpayer investment.
Wow.
If you give someone $200,000, you know, and to take care of your kid, I think we could do that adequately. But
you make a beautiful case for that. Wow.
Yeah.
Jennifer, I'm so glad we talked to you. I had no idea, and I think you've enlightened a lot of listeners today, and I really appreciate it. I wish you the best of luck with the campaign, and let us know what happens with that, okay?
Definitely. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. Jennifer Kim is Senior Policy Analyst for Books Not Bars. That's a campaign of the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights. You're listening to In Deep. I'm Angie Cairo. Stick around for another hour of In Deep. You can follow us on Twitter at In Deep Radio. And we're on Facebook, too, In Deep with Angie Cairo. Send us feedback, suggestions, and even money at our website, indeepradio.com. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Yes, I know it's gonna get better, 'cause it almost always does. I can't say much about the who and how, but I believe it just because. Day by day our bonds unweave, lemon floats as nature grieves. Oh, save us from these pious thieves. It's gonna get worse before it gets better. It's gonna get worse.
Thanks for tuning in this week to In Deep with Angie Cairo, a production of Talkback Studios. You can get more information about us at indeepradio.com. And while you're there, you can become a member and support our work. There's a link there to contact us, too, with any questions or feedback. We're developing a series on mental health issues in our country, especially in this economy, and we'd love to have you be part of that. Please send us your topic suggestions, your stories, and your questions through our website. Click the contact button at indeepradio.com. Join us again this time next week for two more hours of in-depth conversation. I'm Angie Cairo. We'll see you then. You're listening to WPWC 1480 AM, Dumfries, Virginia. We Act Radio, home of Washington's progressive working community.